Good morning. Representative Dave Pinto here, calling to order the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee, calling that committee to order. I'm one of the co-chairs of the committee, along with Representative Dave Baker. Welcome to all. We have hearing today on misclassification of workers. Actually, on the drive-in, was hearing about some information that the Federal Department of Labor is issuing on this topic, so it's one that's timely. We will start with the adoption of our minutes because there is a quorum. Chair Baker, are you willing to move adoption of those minutes from March 4th, 2026? Chair Baker moves approval.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Members, any additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the March 4th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. That motion passes. Members, two notes on the agenda. One is that there will be there's an additional testifier we'll be bringing in. We'll address that. I know there's a lot of material. We'll keep it moving. There was briefly a bill that had been posted yesterday afternoon that came significantly late because of some miscommunication on the DFL side. The chair has consulted, and that bill we won't be doing the informational hearing on that bill at this time. May do it at a later time, but just in case there's any confusion. So we will bring up then Leah Takpu, a former colleague of mine, up to the front to kick us off, to ground us in what misclassification is and how it impacts workers in government. And welcome to you. And as you get settled in, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. And members, just one note also, I budgeted a few minutes for questions after each one of these presentations. My thinking is that if there's a clarifying question in the middle of a presentation, that's fine if it's real short. If there's kind of a little more clarification you want after each individual presentation, fine. But then my hope is that we can save larger discussion largely for the end. But don't want to stop things along the way if there's points to be made. So please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Good morning to you and to all the members of the committee. My name is Leah Takpu, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. I also manage our wage theft division here at the AG's office. We're here today to talk about misclassification fraud, a topic that you're all familiar with. As you'll hear, this is an issue that many of us have been working on for some time now through the Minnesota Attorney General's Task Force on Misclassification and through the Misclassification Enforcement Education Partnership, or as we call the partnership, or MEEP. You'll hear testifiers who will discuss how misclassification fraud has impacted them, the labor market, and the efforts that are underway to address this problem. But before diving into some of these details about how misclassification has impacted folks, I want to just give you all a brief refresher on what misclassification fraud is. Misclassification fraud is sometimes referred to as payroll fraud, employee misclassification, or simply misclassification. This is a practice of labeling workers as independent contractors rather than employees. By misclassifying their workers, employers avoid paying minimum wage, overtime, unemployment, other taxes, and workers' compensation. It goes without saying that this reduces the labor costs for the employer, but places the burden instead on the misclassified employee and on the state. It places the burden on the state because it results in the state receiving less money in tax revenue. And put simply, misclassification fraud is ripping off workers and taxpayers. So I want to talk a little bit about how it works and just in a real general sense. You'll start with an employer who hires a new person, a new worker, and it could be, or they could be, in some cases, changing the status of an existing worker, and they classify them as an independent contractor. Maybe they were previously a W-2 employee, but now they're told that they're going to start receiving a 1099, or they come into the business and they're told that they're going to receive a 1099 right out the gate. In some situations, the employer might try to sell this as a benefit to the worker and give them the idea that they're becoming a business owner and that this is advantageous for them to do so, perhaps that they'll be taking home some more money. In other situations, the worker simply doesn't know that they're being classified as an independent contractor. In all of these situations, the worker often does not know what it means or what they could lose out on in terms of the benefits of employment. So when the worker signs, in some cases, a worker might sign an independent contractor agreement or may even register as a business. We've heard reports of workers who are brought in and actually walked through the process of signing up and registering as a business by the employer or the former, the person who previously was acting as their employer, to help them register as a business. But they function as a business in name only, because in practice, they are treated like employees. And this is the crucial piece, because it is not this contract or this agreement that they have. It is how the law defines them as an independent contractor or as an employee. A worker who is classified as employee cannot simply waive his or her legal protections by agreeing to a contract with an employer. This illegal practice by employers happens in many industries throughout our state. Oftentimes we learn about this when a worker is eventually ripped off, and we receive hundreds of complaints from workers who find out when they are denied overtime, or they're denied minimum wage, or when they are denied paid leave to care for a sick family member, when they lose their jobs and file for unemployment insurance only to be denied. Or sometimes we learn about it from a different small business who reports to us that they, because they are playing by the rules and they are treating their workers fairly, their business is being driven out by the bad actors who commit misclassification fraud and who are able to undercut their competition on prices because they're paying less for their labor. The overall rate of misclassification in Minnesota is currently unknown. And as you already know, a state study is underway to get a better sense of how pervasive this problem is. And you'll hear more about these efforts later in this presentation. Until that study is complete, I can tell you what we do know about the frequency. According to an estimate by the 2024 OLA report, 22% of employers subjected to an unemployment insurance audit misclassified at least one employee in 2018. This aligns with our experience at the Attorney General's office, where approximately 22% of our complaints in 2024 involved misclassification. Of the AGO complaints, we have found that about 67% of these complaints came from three industries: construction, the gig economy, and healthcare. Now, the monetary effects of misclassification is massive. Again, it is hard to quantify exact numbers, but one study estimates that Minnesota workers lose between $2.9 and $6.2 billion annually in compensation. The same study further estimates that the state loses between an estimated $505 million and $1.3 billion in tax revenue from state income tax, workers' compensation premiums, and unemployment insurance contributions. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not talking about legitimate independent contractors. There's absolutely a place in the labor market for them, and without a doubt, there are many legitimate businesses and independent contractors who properly classify their workers. The businesses that do follow the rules by correctly classifying their employees and treating their workers fairly are some of the biggest losers in this situation. We are concerned about the 22% of employers who commit misclassification fraud, and in doing so, they're stealing wages and benefits from workers, they're stealing money from taxpayers, they steal work from other businesses, and they steal resources from the social safety net that you all have put in place. Our task is to identify and to stop the businesses who cheat the system and who are rewarded for it. It is unacceptable, and we appreciate this committee's attention on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Stay where you are, Representative Schultz.
Thank you. Excited for this morning, Mr. Chair. It's good for us to be talking about worker misclassification. I am just elated to see the number of people in attendance this morning, just very excited for this. So I'll just start for you. I want to say your last name right.
Is it Atapu?
There we go.
Silent kick.
A takpu. There we go. All right. So anyways, my question for you is, at the beginning of your presentation, you said that there is an unknown number of misclassification reports. Then later on, you went on to cite specific numbers saying that compensation could total between $2.9 billion and $6.2 billion. And you went on to say that 22% of employers potentially commit worker misclassification. If we don't know the number of misclassification reports, how is it possible for us to know the number of employers who are committing worker misclassification?
Mr. Takpu.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. It is and the opportunity to clarify. So there are estimates, studies that out there that provide estimates of how the rate of misclassification, which is some of the information that I was referencing. The exact number is unknown. It is, as you can imagine, if there are employers who are misclassifying their employees, or they're not reporting them as employees, and so it's hard to know what exactly how often it's happening. If we're not receiving complaints about it, it's hard to know exactly how often it's happening. And in the underground economy, where some workers are not even on board or not even on papers being employees or independent contractors, it can be hard to get those exact figures. That being said, the numbers that I did cite, the 22% that were, there's an estimate in the study that estimated 22%, but then there is, in addition to that, we have our own complaints and complaint trackers that we receive. So 22% of the complaints that we've received in 2024 involve misclassification. And so you can, there's kind of some different numbers that are there. Some of them are estimates. Some of them are our own internal Attorney General.
Representative Schultz, yeah, and recognizing we've got a study that is coming next year, and also we're going to get an update on it from a later presenter, but Representative Schultz.
Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We always want to base ourselves on the truth, the facts, and the data, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm committed to that. I know that you are, Mr. Chair, and so many of us. And I just, as we begin this discussion this morning, let's base ourselves in the data that we have readily available today, and we're excited to get the data going further, and let's make sure that we're coloring this debate appropriately. Thank you, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Yeah, and I'll maybe note that I don't know that there's a conflict between we don't have hard numbers and kind of here. So when you say 2.9 to 6 point, I forget what the number of that, a billion, that's a pretty broad range, right? So I think it's, we're talking about estimates. But yeah, over the course of it, let's keep an eye on future, on further presenters. So we will start bringing our testifiers up. So thank you, Mr. Takpu, unless there's other things right now. So thank you. And so first testifier, Kevin Pranis, and as you come up, and we'll have testifiers come up, fill up the chairs so we can make sure we're not. So Matt Wohlers, if you can come up as well. And the additional testifier I mentioned, Jesse Madison, if you can make your way up to the third chair. As they settle in, I just want to note Mr. Takpu had referenced a legislative audit report from March of 2024. And I should have brought this up at the beginning. The finding there was that, quote, Minnesota has neither an adequate nor coordinated approach for ensuring the Minnesota workers are properly classified. That was 2 years ago, and we've made a lot of progress since then and more to do, and that'll be what we'll be hearing the rest of this this morning. Mr. Pranis, once you're ready, please identify yourself and proceed, and I'll remind each of these testifiers, ask you to stay under 4 minutes, and I'm going to be keeping an eye on the time just so we can keep moving. Mr. Pranis.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and Chair Baker and committee members. My name is Kevin Pranis. I'm here on behalf of Liuna, Minnesota, North Dakota. We represent over 14,000 construction laborers who live all across Minnesota and work for construction contractors alongside other building trades unions, some like the carpenters represented here today. And we work with more than 800 contractor partners, a large majority of which are small family-owned businesses with fewer than 20 employees. I want to thank the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Labor and Industry and the legislators and stakeholders who've been working on this issue over years. I think we're making progress. It feels slow, but it's because it's a complicated problem. Just a couple of observations. So we deal with this all the time. Our contractors deal with this all the time. Misclassification is not a major problem in every segment of the construction industry, but there are parts of construction where it is rampant and remains rampant today. right? And whether that's the carpenters can talk about drywall, we see this in stucco, we see it in sort of thin stone installation, and we see it in broadband installation, most surprisingly, which we've seen all summer, just a wildly rampant cases of misclassification. But when we're talking about misclassification, and to be clear, this is fraud, right? It is tax fraud, it is unemployment insurance fraud, and most of the time it's also workers' comp fraud that is stealing from us, and I'll get to examples of how that sort of steals from taxpayers, from insurance payers, et cetera. But I think there's often a misunderstanding when we talk about independent contractors, right? All of our contractors are called contractors because they work based on contracts, right? So you have a contract that says you will show up at this time and you will do this work and you will do it in this way, and maybe you will use or not use these other subcontractors to do it, right? We are providing all those details, and that is in a contract. It is written, right? It is legally enforceable. You can take it to court, right? That is a contractor. When we talk to workers in the field, that are being misclassified, they don't have contracts. Most of them have never seen a contract, right? The most sophisticated operations, it's like, yeah, 8 years ago, they had me sign a thing. I've never seen it since. I can't get a copy of it. And it no longer reflects any of the terms under which I work, right? But I remember that there was a thing I signed, that they made me sign. Most of the time, they're not signing anything. In fact, independent contract misclassification is not you give a bunch of workers contracts and then pretend they're contractors. They don't give them anything, right? They don't have any paper. They don't have anything documenting who they work for. A lot of times they don't even know who they work for. They're like, well, this is who pays me. This is who hired me. This is who brought me on, and this is who pays me are the only two things that they know. And the misclassification is the cheat code. So if someone comes to investigate and say, hey, wait a minute, why didn't this worker get paid? Where's the work comp for this worker? Where's their unemployment insurance? The contractor above them says, well, they're an independent contractor. Well, how do you know that? It's because we made a verbal agreement. I asked him to come work, and here he is. And so just to be, you know, to be clear, when we're talking to workers in the broadband industry, they're getting paid in Zelle. And if they don't have a Zelle account, they'll pay him in cash, right? Or a check that is not a payroll check, right? It's not clear. No idea what tax authorities know, what the contractor above that is reporting up, right? And we see these chains. We had workers receive a text from an employer who had been cheating them of their wages, not even paying what he promised. And he literally said, you guys should appreciate that I'm not collecting taxes on you, and that's illegal, right? So I'm kind of doing you a favor, so you need to let off on asking me to pay you all the money that I still can't pay you, right? So that's what we're talking about here. We are making progress on the problem. I think we're better defining it within industry so people are starting to understand. I think the general contractor liability question that says that those obligations to pay workers roll up is really important and starting to get people to pay attention. The wage theft law is helpful, but I'd say most workers still have never seen that piece of paper they're required to have that says what they're supposed to make, which makes enforcement hard. And I will say for the Department of Labor and Industry, the cases are hard to enforce. The more non-compliant an employer is, the harder it is to actually get them. Because you go to an employer and you're like, okay, give me your records. Which workers worked on this project? No idea. Either they don't know, right, or they won't tell you. And there's no way to prove that they have that information. It's like, what paperwork do they have? Sure, they don't have payroll. So it's like, how are you supposed to prove there were 20 workers on that project? We saw them. No one knows who their names are. No one has a list, right? There's no information. And so it's months and months for the agency to try to extract from these contractors, many of whom are coming from out of state, right? And so they don't respond. They don't have lawyers. You can't really file a judgment against them effectively. And so that's the stuff we're working on. I would say the solution ultimately, right, we will never have enough enforcement. We need to do more enforcement. We'll never have enough to solve the problem that way. Project owners need to start taking more responsibility for their projects, right? The only reason this happens is because project owners are unaware or often look the other way. What we do is we educate project owners about what's happening on their projects. They are often very surprised. But if you talk to contractors, they're not surprised at all. And so we need to do better. Either industry, the project owners need to start taking responsibility, or the legislature might need to help.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks. You know, a lot to fit into a short amount of time. Appreciate it. Mr. Wohlers, have you start? And then Jesse Madison's going to go next, and then Ben Bellio after that. Mr. Wohlers.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Chair and committee members, my name is Matt Wohlers, and I'm the operations manager at Braxton & Sons, a framing and trim contractor focused on multifamily construction in Minnesota. When our company is busy, we employ around 300 carpenters, earning middle-class wages and benefits. Today, we have about 100 on payroll. We've laid off over 100 carpenters in the past 2 years. At peak capacity, Braxton & Sons can frame and trim more than 5,000 apartment units per year. In 2025, we did less than one-third of that. When the markets While the market slowdown does play a role, a major reason we are shrinking is that we lose bids, and a lot of them, to competitors that I strongly believe are committing employment fraud. These competitors misclassify their workers as independent contractors, issuing 1099s instead of W-2s in order to avoid payroll taxes, workers' compensation premiums, unemployment insurance contributions, wage and hour laws, paid leave requirements, and the obligation to verify that the individuals they are hiring can lawfully work in the United States. That scheme can produce an immediate labor cost advantage of 30% or more over law-abiding contractors like mine. Not because wages are lower, but because they are unlawfully shirking the responsibilities imposed on employers. At a time when we hear about construction labor shortages, I have skilled carpenters I could bring back to work. We simply cannot win enough projects to bring them back because we are being undercut by companies that are not complying with the law. Employee misclassification is not a new issue before this legislature. The legislative auditor has studied it. Minnesota has passed laws to address it. The reality is the problem has gotten worse despite those laws. I'm not here asking for new legislation. I'm asking for meaningful enforcement of the laws that already exist. I'm not alone in making that request. My company is a founding member of the Minnesota Construction Employers Alliance, a group supported by more than 200 construction employers. Formed in 2025 to advocate for enforcement and employment laws in the Minnesota construction industry. Construction is a bid-based industry. The lowest responsible bid typically wins. In multifamily construction, as a labor-only contractor, our labor often represents 80% or more of the cost. When Braxton prepares a bid, we estimate labor hours and include every legally required cost. If we underestimate, we lose money. But our employees are paid properly, and the state receives the taxes and premiums required by law. Companies using the misclassification model operate differently. In some cases, they maintain a small core of W-2 employees to create the appearance of legitimacy while misclassifying most of their workforce as 1099 contractors. The crews work side by side doing the same tasks under the same supervision. Based on our company's experience, framing and trim work on an average apartment unit requires about 120 hours of labor. The combined employee and employer tax, insurance, and paid leave obligations for that work total almost $2,850 per unit. On a 100-unit building, that's nearly $285,000 in payroll-related costs just on the framing and trim alone. When multiplied across thousands of units built annually in Minnesota, this represents tens of millions of dollars in avoided obligations. That's not a minor accounting issue, it's a structural distortion of the marketplace. No company can ever beat a competitor who simply does not pay the same legal obligations. Minnesota has laws to address this. The challenge is enforcement. These schemes rely on workers who are reluctant to cooperate with investigators. Workers move from project to project. Investigations are complex, and cheaters use shell entities or labor brokers to avoid being caught. Meanwhile, law-abiding employers are losing bids today. My industry needs consistent and visible enforcement of Minnesota's employment laws. As an employer, I'm asking for more enforcement efforts. My specific request is simple. State officials should be visiting construction job sites on a regular and unannounced basis to verify compliance with employment laws. The legal tools already exist. They need to be used. Law-abiding employers should not have to choose between following the law and staying in business. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your work. Jesse Madison is up next, and then Ben Baglio, if you can make your way up, and Moses Heisen can take the third seat. So we're all set and ready to go. Jesse Madison, please identify yourself and proceed. Affiliations, that's not on our written agenda.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Jesse Madison. I'm the founder and CEO of Purple Tally Productions. We specialize in staffing and payroll services for things like major sports, entertainment, live events here in Minnesota. I started the company on my own in 2014. We've now grown it to a 15 to 20 person company based here in Bloomington, Minnesota. This is my sixth testimony before a committee of this type on behalf of the Attorney General Task Force. I'm going to speak directly to the members who are hesitant to strengthen these misclassification laws because I do understand the instinct. I grew up in a Ronald Reagan household, okay? Union was not a good word in my house. That's how I grew up. So I understand. You hear more enforcement, you picture more paperwork, more audits, more government, and fewer independent contractors who actually want to be independent. That's what you hear. So let me start here. Just like the gentleman said a couple people ago, we're not here to eliminate legitimate 1099 work. My industry depends on it, the legitimate ones. I'm asking you to stop one specific business model, very, very well described by the gentleman testifying before me. Companies that win work by cheating. They let everyone else pay the bill after they win that work by cheating. Here's the part that doesn't get said enough in these meetings. Worker misclassification is not pro-business, it's anti-competition. If you believe in competition, you should not tolerate payroll fraud discounts for cheaters. That's what this is. It's a tax and insurance dodge. It creates a state-sponsored discount for the worst actors, and it punishes the companies trying to do it right. You've heard this time and time again. I don't know what it's going to take to get you guys to help back this up, but we're not making it up. For Representative Schultz, I want to speak directly to you. Here are some concrete facts and data you can be aware of. You said you weren't sure how to verify this data. I'll give you something you can verify. 2 weeks ago, Dave Chappelle, the famous actor and comedian, was at Grand Casino Arena. They recorded a comedy show for Netflix. He contracted with a company called Magic Lemonade. It's a production company out of Los Angeles. They hired a company called Telescope Media Group, run by Carl Larson. He's a St. Cloud-based guy. They partnered with another Minnesota company, Crash and Sue's. They hired all kinds of, over six figures worth of labor, all misclassified, to record his event right down the road at Grand Casino Arena. That's concrete. You can look into it. I'll give you something more personal. In 2023, I lost $105,000 because of misclassification that was available as an option in the market. The enforcement was too inconsistent, so these people just were not afraid to break the rules and go right into the convention center with misclassified labor. That's payroll we could have added. With my payroll, you're gonna get the taxes. You're gonna get all the benefits of W-2 companies who follow the law. That same bad actor, Joshua Giles Ministries, for the record, stiffed the Minneapolis Convention Center for over $110,000. There's some concrete evidence you can sink your teeth into. Now, if you're thinking that sounds like a private dispute, I get it, but it isn't. Because when a company misclassifies, the costs don't disappear, they get shifted. They shift onto honest employers who pay workers' comp and unemployment. They shift onto public programs when someone gets hurt and there's no coverage. They shift onto every taxpayer when payroll taxes aren't paid. And they shift onto the worker who gets left holding the bag. This is my challenge to the opposition. If you believe in free markets, you should hate misclassification. This is not something that is Democrat or Republican. It rewards cheating and it blocks honest businesses, especially small Minnesota businesses, from growing. You heard it from the gentleman before me very clearly. The solution actually does not need to be heavy-handed. That's not necessary. In my world, a proactive fix is simple. You start at the top of the contracting chain. The venue, the buyer, the employer of record. Very easy information to obtain. These are high-profile events booked months in advance. You could just put a basic front-end checkpoint in place. Show us your workers' comp. Show us your unemployment coverage. Show us who's W-2 and who's truly 1099 before you get the gig and before you can work in our venues. Not after the fact. Do it before the work starts. Big government. That's basic guardrails so the cheaters can't underbid everyone else.
I'll need to have you wrap up, I'm afraid.
Lastly, I would ask the opposition to worry less about damage that might happen and worry more about damage that is happening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your work. Ben Balio, we'll move to you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Ben Balio. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association. MNA's 22,000 members represent 80% of the nurses that actively work at the bedside in Minnesota's hospitals, while our members also include nurses in long-term care, clinics, local public health, state mental health facilities and prisons, and other settings. I appreciate the opportunity to testify about worker misclassification in the healthcare industry, specifically in nursing. As I hope you've all already seen, submitted for the record in this hearing is a report from the Roosevelt Institute called Uber for Nursing, which details how private equity-backed tech companies are funding smartphone-based apps to circumvent existing nurse practice and licensure processes, misclassifying nurses as independent contractors in the process. These companies seek to circumvent unions and collective bargaining agreements by creating their own special little spot in statutes just for them outside of the existing regulatory framework that already governs temporary nurse licensure in order to make it easier for these companies to drive down wages. Most of these apps treat nurses and other workers as independent contractors, despite the fact that most nurses and healthcare workers would tell you that this is counter to how care teams, patient assignments, and general accountability works in a hospital or other healthcare setting. When nurses are assigned a shift through one of these apps, there's little to no assurance that the nurse is being assigned a particular shift or to particular patients, having received proper orientation to the facility, or if they even have the proper training or experience necessary to take on the patients that they're being assigned through by the app. Rather than considering patient acuity, training, or skill mix, which a human being would factor in as they're making staffing decisions as a hospital administrator, or nurses would as they would take whether or not they would take a shift, these apps instead use automated systems to assign shifts, set rates of pay, or even rank workers according to metrics that aren't even shared with the workers themselves as a means to fueling the algorithm that will decide who gets offered a shift. These apps track behavioral data, like data they purchase from social media companies to see which nurses might be hurting the most financially and might be desperate enough to take a shift well below the wage rate that. They also track and use their own in-house data, like a nurse's typical response time when the app sends their phone a push notification about an available shift. In some cases, and this is also documented in the Uber for Nursing report, these apps will actually pit nurses against each other by initiating a sort of reverse auction, where nurses enter their bid, meaning the hourly wage they're willing to accept to take the shift, with the lowest bidder being awarded the shift. This type of worker misclassification scheme, paired with the unfair wage and workforce market manipulation practices they deploy, have no place in patient care. And yet we believe that hospitals and other healthcare employers turning to these apps are turning to these apps rather than addressing their own worker retention issues. And that might end up being the greatest healthcare worker misclassification issue of our day. Healthcare is not ride sharing. When shift assignments and compensation algorithms are volatile and opaque for workers and driven by algorithms and fees not disclosed to workers until the last possible second, it destabilizes the workforce. These practices erode basic equal pay norms, and it will ultimately drive down the quality of care in our state if they're allowed to take stronghold here in Minnesota. If the acuity and other specific needs of individual patients is made to be of secondary importance to maximizing the profits of coastal private equity investors who funded a smartphone app, no one but those investors win. In other states, we know these have spread to most care settings, including hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and home care. M&A can't speak to how widespread the use of these apps are in our state, and frankly, I don't think anyone can. Although we do know that these are being used across a variety of settings, and we know that one of these apps, as of a couple weeks ago, was currently offering shifts in four settings here in Minnesota: hospitals, clinics, veterans care, and for ICE detention facilities. We appreciate the opportunity to talk about this issue, especially as this topic continues to pop up here at the legislature, and we're committed at M&A to making sure nursing is never treated as gig work. Thanks again, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much. I'll ask Aaron Rosenthal to come on up because you'll be after Melissa Heising to the testifier table. And also noting, members, there are quite a few materials in the packet, including the Uber for Nursing report that was just referenced by Mr. Balio, and there's a handout about the Construction Employers Alliance that Matt Wohler's referenced as well. So, Melissa Heising, turning to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Heising, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Our state's voluntary Democratic Labor Federation, representing 1,000 local unions with more than 300,000 members in the public sector, private sector, and building trades across the state. I also had the honor of serving on the Attorney General's Task Force on Worker Misclassification. At its core, misclassification is about whether working people in Minnesota are actually protected by the laws you pass. Working people have a reasonable expectation that when the government enacts minimum wage laws, overtime protections, paid sick and safe time, paid family and medical leave, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, and collective bargaining rights, those protections will apply to them. But when employers misclassify workers as independent contractors while treating them like employees, those workers are cut off from every single one of those rights. We heard hours of testimony on the task force from workers and advocates in construction, transportation, retail, warehouse, entertainment, sports, nonprofit, and building services industries. Misclassification is not isolated to one bad actor or one sector. It is widespread and, according to the 2024 report by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, increasing. When employers misclassify workers, they deny them minimum wage, overtime, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, earned sick and safe time, paid leave, and the right to organize. At the same time, those employers avoid paying unemployment insurance premiums and payroll taxes that fund the very social safety net working families rely on. That creates a race to the bottom. Law-abiding employers who play by the rules are undercut by competitors who cheat. Taxpayers lose revenue and state programs are strained. One of the clearest lessons from the task force was that misclassification fraud enforcement has historically been fragmented and confusing. Workers often don't know where to file a complaint or which agency has jurisdiction. We appreciate that in 2024, the legislature strengthened and streamlined enforcement, created the Intergovernmental Misclassification Enforcement Partnership, and funded a misclassification fraud impact report to better understand the scope of the problem. Those were important steps, but we must continue this work. In recent years, Minnesota has expanded worker protections, including paid leave, earned sick and safe time, and other stronger labor standards, but these protections only matter if workers are properly classified. As digital platform companies multiply and classify entire workforces as independent contractors, this issue is only becoming more urgent. Worker misclassification is not a technical paperwork issue. It is wage theft. It is tax avoidance. And it is a direct threat to the integrity of our labor standards. We urge you to continue strengthening enforcement and ensuring that every worker in Minnesota is properly classified and fully protected under our laws. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And then final testifier is Aaron Rosenthal from North Star Policy Action. And I will note that there's a report that I'm assuming they'll be referencing. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members of the committee. Yes, I will be talking about the report that's included in your packet that's already been discussed today. So I'm Aaron Rosenthal. I'm the research director with North Star Policy Action, a think tank dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. I'm here today to offer testimony on that analysis that I conducted in September of 2024, which represented the first effort to estimate both the scale and cost of worker misclassification in Minnesota. Our research found that nearly 10% of Minnesota's private sector workforce, representing over 300,000 workers, experienced misclassification fraud in 2019. Notably, our analysis found high levels of misclassification in sectors that are known for it, that have been discussed today, such as construction and transportation, but also in places that tend to receive less attention, such as finance and retail. In doing so, our results align with the 2024 report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, which similarly found high levels of misclassification fraud in multiple industries. Put simply, this issue is not isolated to one part of the state's economy. As for cost, the losses are pretty staggering. Again, these have been discussed already, but we estimated that workers lost between $2.9 and $6.2 billion in compensation due to misclassification fraud in 2019. If we adjust that for inflation, it would suggest that workers today are failing to receive over $8 billion each year, coming in the form of lost paid leave, overtime pay, health and retirement benefits, among other forms of compensation. That lost compensation allows employers engaging in misclassification fraud to illegally reduce their labor costs, placing businesses that follow the law at a competitive disadvantage. Such a race to the bottom benefits no one. Beyond harm to workers, we also know that misclassification fraud comes with a cost for state government, as fraudulent employers avoid contributing to programs that would be required if they correctly classified their workers as employees. We estimate that the state of Minnesota lost out on up to $1.3 billion in revenue due to a lack of income tax collection, unemployment insurance contributions, and workers' compensation premiums. Ultimately, it is Minnesota taxpayers who eat this cost, forced to plug the gaps created by misclassification fraud. We believe that as large as these estimates are, they likely represent a conservative estimate of the damage being done. For example, our analysis did not include losses due to workers being paid off the books in cash, which are much more difficult to find in the data. We also did not consider revenue hits to other state programs that rely on payroll taxes, such as paid family and medical leave and the Workforce Development Fund. Our research demonstrates the scale of worker misclassification as a problem. Given our findings showing that billions of dollars are being lost to state programs and hardworking Minnesotans, we believe addressing misclassification fraud should be a top priority for the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important issue.
Thank you so much, and stay where you are. Representative Schultz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the information that you're able to provide for us. I know that you're probably one of our state's top researchers topic, just based upon the number of times that you and your work has been in front of this committee over the last couple of years. I wonder through your studies if you have studied the impact on worker misclassification to consumers and taxpayers, and I'm putting taxpayers through the lens of a consumer in this impact or in this moment, because I'm curious. Let's just take, for example, we heard about an event at Grand Casino Arena a little bit ago. Had the law been effectively enforced and had there not been misclassification as was stated or alleged, what would the impact have been to consumers and potentially the people who attended the event that was mentioned?
Mr. Rosenthal?
Chair Pinto, Representative Schultz, I want to make sure that I'm understanding the question. So my understanding would be that potentially consumers would end up with, in this case, let's say higher ticket prices if labor were being paid a fair wage and not undercut by skirting employment classification laws. Is that my understanding correctly?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm wondering if you have studied that. That's my curiosity. Like you are mentioning one lens through which there is lost revenue. I am curious as to where you are seeing that revenue would come from. Okay, so if you're saying that a business is misclassifying and then therefore not paying their employees, and then that employee it doesn't receive payment, if that employee was paid, where is that money coming from?
Sure.
If you've studied that on a statewide scale.
Mr. Rosenthal.
Yeah, Chair Pinto, Representative Schultz. So we have not studied that. I think one way of thinking about this is, right, we can't really segment, I think, in the way that potentially your question would suggest, consumers from workers, who of course are the same people. So potentially we would see, I suppose, and I would certainly defer to people who are working in these industries, costs go up. But at the same time, we would also be seeing people getting paid adequate wages, allowing for them to afford presumably potentially slightly higher goods. But we have to think about to what degree should we be allowing for prices to be dropped by employers and businesses engaging in illegality. I don't think that we want to end up with an economy or an economic system in which we say, well, we'll take lower costs on the backs of exploited workers who are being treated illegally.
Representative Schultz,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just going to be a closing comment. Like, I appreciate what you're saying. I hear you. I think that it's just we would be misinformed to only consider one side of the ledger. That's all that I'm saying. Like, we should consider the whole picture as best as we possibly can on this conversation. I am not suggesting that a worker should be misclassified at all.
Yeah.
I am saying we need to have a full picture and make sure that the data, and especially from someone who researches this, that's what I'm seeking, is the greatest data possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No problem. Thanks. I have a thought relating to that. It may be the same as Representative Johnson's, but I'll let you go, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. That is a unique and interesting line of thought. So my question, I do have a question for you. Maybe you can clarify on the same line. In the work that you've done around workers and worker protections and dealing with companies or organizations that commit fraud and and to make money ultimately, right? That's their goal, to misclass these workers. Do you generally see them roll those savings back to the consumers, or is that something they keep for themselves?
Mr. Rosenthal.
Chair Pinto, Representative, it's not something that we study in our analysis, but I think there's a relatively good indication that, yes, that money is not being realized through cut costs for consumers, but is being hoarded by the people engaging in misclassification.
I will say, Representative Johnson, we'll go back to you. You had something else?
No, I'm good.
Okay. And Representative Schultz, it is an intriguing line of questions. Several of us are on the Public Safety Committee, and yesterday there was a presentation of a group seeking to change how we address organized retail theft. And it actually had not occurred to me to ask. It probably would have been good to make sure that they would study sort of the benefit of shoplifting and of retail theft, and because perhaps people are relying on that and sort of using that. Maybe it's, you know, assisting them in some way. I mean, these folks were describing people violating the law, I suppose it could be useful to look into that, but ultimately it's a policy question, right? We do want to make sure when we have a law in place we're enforcing it. So anyway, thank you for that line of questioning. It's intriguing. Thank you, Mr. Rosenthal, and we'll move on to our presentation from the Attorney General's Misclassification Task Force. And this is a presentation, I believe, and I don't know if we're set up to have you projected or if we're... But if not, I know members, we've got, I think this is correct, right, Mr. Putt? We're getting it plugged in. Oh, we're getting it all set. Okay, good. Perfect. So then once anybody's ready, whoever's going to go first, identify yourself and proceed. And members, we do have the presentation in our packets and also online for members of the public as well.
Thank you. I need my slightly younger than me colleague to show me how to start the presentation. good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Rotz. I'm the Senior Advisor for Policy and Special Projects in the Attorney General's Office. And I am here to present about the Worker Misclassification Task Force that you've heard about a few times and how that process worked. So first, I'll give you some context on AGO task forces. Attorney General's Office task forces allow us to assemble a group of experts and Minnesotans with a certain type of experience around an issue to study it, to do a deep dive into research, hear testimony from around the state, and then really work together to generate some creative solutions across a range of backgrounds and experiences and ultimately make a set of recommendations to the public. And those could be policy, they could be procedural or broader public recommendations. And then these recommendations are public documents that become available for use by agencies or legislators to be acted on at some point in the future. We decided to do a task force on worker misclassification in 2023 for a couple of reasons. First, we knew it had been many years since the state had officially studied the problem. It had been since 2007. And we knew that the legislative auditor was doing a study and a report, and our hope was that the timing would work out so the results would become available during our process. They did, in order to incorporate that data into our learning. We also knew that state responses to worker misclassification were diffuse, so DLI would get the wage theft piece, DEED would get the UI piece, revenue would get the payroll tax piece, and we wondered if we could get all of these folks together, could we come up with a more collaborative approach that would more comprehensively address the problem. So we announced the task force publicly in the summer of 2023. We held an open application process, and we ended up seating 15 voting members, and those included worker advocates, and that included both traditional labor unions but also non-traditional worker resource centers. We had representation from campaigns in support of freelancers. We had academics and researchers. We had representatives from revenue, DEED, and DLI. We had legislators. And then we also had a number of task force members who just represented Minnesotans from a number of different backgrounds. So we had some municipal labor law people. We had, like I said, advocates for freelancers and independent contractors. We had a representative from the Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce. And so we worked to create some geographical and perspective diversity. We began meeting in September of 2023. And we began hearing presentations from experts that represented a range of different perspectives. We heard from North Star Policy Action and Aaron, who you just heard from. We heard from the National Employment Law Project, academics from NYU, Rutgers, the University of Minnesota. When the OLA report was released, we had somebody from the OLA come and present it. We heard from companies like DoorDash and TaskRabbit. We heard from think tanks like the Mercatus Center. We heard from our own agencies, both about the problem, about the way that other states had addressed it, and potential solutions that we could look at in Minnesota. And then the other thing that we spent the bulk of our time on was hearing testimony from the public. These meetings were all held hybrid, so we were always in person and on Teams, and we took public testimony in both ways. We also took a significant amount of written testimony from the public. And we heard some of our 3-hour meetings were dedicated to only testimony. And we heard public testimony from every industry, from construction, both workers and employers, from the entertainment industry, from stagehands who you've heard from, but also voiceover actors, small business owners, from accountants to cartographers, lawyers, gig workers, employers and workers from a lot of different industries. At the end of 2023, after meeting for several months, the group felt that they'd heard enough and had enough of an idea of how to at least start generating some recommendations. So they moved forward some interim recommendations that were debated and discussed in December of 2023 and then formally adopted in January of 2024. Those recommendations were turned into a policy proposal by Representative Greenman and Senator Claire Umover-Bayton. And they went to the legislature in the 2024 session where they passed. I'll run quickly through what some of those were. We updated Minnesota's construction misclassification law, which was about successor entities that if you are, you know, misclassifying, you can't then pass your business down to somebody else. We modified penalties and enforcement provisions in the existing statute. We modified our independent contractor statute in construction. We created a private right of action so that employees can go to court for themselves when they've been misclassified. And then importantly, we created that collaborative interagency misclassification, enforcement, and education partnership, which was made up of DLI, Revenue, Deed, Commerce, and our office. And like I said, this legislation passed in 2024, and I think you'll hear about the misclassification partnership in a bit. Then the task force continued meeting. In total, we had 16 meetings that were hybrid. We heard in total about 12 full hours of testimony, and we took, some significant written testimony. And then the task force adopted an additional set of recommendations in 2024. Those were in your packet, and I'm going to let Lee talk about them in just a minute. But the last thing I will say is that these were all public meetings, and so all of the agendas, the recordings, materials distributed are all available on the Attorney General's website. I know you can't click that link, but you can go to our website and search Misclassification Task Force, and it'll take you right to the page. Thank you.
And thank you. Mr. Chakpu, are you going to be speaking now? Yeah, please.
Thank you again, Chair Pinto. And I'll just be really brief here, just to really to draw attention again to this, the recommendations that were developed over a year plus of everything that Ms. Moratz just discussed, open discussion, a lot of deliberation between all the task force members, trying to come up with some the best solutions in hearing the varied perspectives that were in front of the task force and the varied positions of people who testified to the committee or to the task force. So again, this is what it looks like. I'm not going to go through all of it. There are a number of recommendations here that it wouldn't be worth it for me to go through each one of them. But I would just draw your attention that they fell into four general buckets and then kind of the fifth miscellaneous bucket at the end. But the four main buckets are measuring the problem and impact, the data and research. You need to know what you're dealing with. You need to know how big and how wide the problem is before you can really start to address it. It talks about education and outreach and notice. We want to make sure that, you know, this isn't a got-you opportunity. This isn't a way to try to punish or penalize businesses. We want to make sure that if we're, as a state, going to put some more enforcement action in this area, that we're going to, that businesses have the resources that they need, that workers have the information that they need to be able to make sure that they avoid this problem in the first place. There's a section on co-enforcement and government enforcement reforms. You know, that section, again, with the legislation that Ms. Moratz discussed that brought together these four enforcement agencies in the Attorney General's office to work together. So finding ways to collaborate, find ways to improve, identify best practices, make sure that we are maximizing our resources and we're not, you know, duplicating work or creating redundancies for the taxpayers. And then a section on classification tests. And this is something that we haven't talked a whole lot about here today, but the classification, the test for misclassification in Minnesota, there are several, and they are can be challenging to work with for enforcers. They also can be challenging for employers and employees and workers to fully understand, because there are different tests. They are similar. There's overlap, but there are differences between them. And so identifying the right test and how to use it, depending on what the situation is, the idea that came out of the task force is that there needs to be a real hard look on how you approach that and if there are better ways to have a test that works for everyone and can really make sure that the enforcement and the problem misclassification is addressed. And I would also just note that several of the recommendations that are in this document have already been put into play. You know, there are things that we already seen, again, including the measuring the problem, the study that you'll be hearing about soon that is underway. And the remainder are for you to consider. So I appreciate, again, your time, and thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll see if we have questions right now for Representative Schultz. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just so interested. So
no,
I'm,
you are. Excited, you said at the start
of
the hearing.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep going, man.
So to the Attorney General's office, based upon current statute and worker misclassification challenges that may exist in the state today, how many cases have there been that you have been working on over the last 12 months or the last year?
Mr. Takpu.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I don't know that I have a number of exact cases that we've been working on. I could draw back to a report that our office, the AG's office, filed with the legislature in last fall, the 8.15 report. We determined that we spent about, I believe it was 41% of our time working on cases involving misclassification. So that's including the intake, reviewing those cases as they come in. It's reviewing engaging in the investigation. It's if a case is if we determine that there is reason to believe that there's misclassification that is underway and there's not some sort of agreement or settlement that we can come with the employer, we have the ability to bring a file a case with the district court. And so that litigation, as you imagine, as you know, takes an extraordinary amount of time and resources. And so we have a team of five attorneys, two investigators, and again, and this isn't including admin time, about 41% of our time from the period between September 2024 and August 2025 was about 41% of our time.
Representative Schultz?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yep. My purpose here is just to try and gain as good of a picture as possible as to like how prevalent this is and the amount of resources that is being expended by the Attorney General's office on this. And especially, you know, for our purposes, whether it's the legislation that Representative Greenman passed, to truly understand, you know, how well the law is being implemented and enforced and how effective that's been.
Good for us to know as much about this as possible. Representative Greenman, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a clarification on that, too, because as the co-chair of the task force, one of the things we learned was the AG's office is doing enforcement, DLI is doing enforcement, DEED is doing enforcement, revenue is doing enforcement, because when you misclassify someone, there's tax fraud that happens, there's ripping off of the unemployment insurance and now PFML, and there is things that come to them. And then I think we're going to hear from DLI specifically about their enforcement efforts. It is worth just a plug for the bill we passed on the misclassification partnership, which is part of what we heard in the OLA report and part of what we have heard consistently, is like having that siloed approach actually made it harder to say where is this happening in high risk industries, where is this happening, where we could get sort of economies of scale by taking on more than just piecemeal when we see it. But I'll just note that the data coming in that Deed and Revenue have is the best sort of look, because they have people, there's an audit that goes with unemployment insurance. Revenue obviously has sort of all of the tax filings. And so getting the AG, DLI, Deed, and Revenue all looking at the same sets of things will hopefully, we're now a year and a half in, but that's one of the things I'm interested in, will actually make our enforcement more effective than just asking the piecemeal question of each of those agencies.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and to our testifiers for being here, and just the enormous work that has gone into unearthing this massive issue. I mean, looking at 22% or 1 in 4 employers who are misclassifying, and just kind of piggybacking off some of the questions around data. I know we're talking about like high-risk industries. I'm also curious about the workers themselves and high-risk populations. I've done a lot of work with folks in this room around minimum wage in your office, as well as like violence against Latina communities and others. And so just curious if you and how this interplays with the anti-discrimination work and interplay with like Human Rights Act, or if you're seeing population trends, you know, with minimum wage, we've seen, and this impacts a lot of the same folks, the low-wage workers, as people of color, people with disabilities, you know, J-1 visa holders, immigrants, and other folks. And so if you could just speak to maybe what work you've done to interact with folks from those populations, but then what, if anything, you're seeing out of trends from the data with misclassification.
Yeah, let me talk to you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and Representative. I appreciate the question. In terms of data, I don't know that I can provide data exactly what that has looked like for us. I will say that we do know that misclassification in large parts is affecting disenfranchised communities more than other communities, because the people who are most susceptible and most vulnerable to being preyed upon or to being put in a position where they need to find a job and don't ask too many questions and aren't or don't have the resources to push back against an employer who might be putting forward some unscrupulous terms or some illegal terms to them, that those groups can be more affected by this. Again, I don't have data to support that, and so, but it's just anecdotally is my experience and knowing, and the complaints that we get in, and again, the complaints that we get in, we're not keeping data on how those demographics, you know, the demographics of the complainants. We're looking at each complaint that comes in. We're looking at you know, whether or not it appears to violate the law, whether or not there's something that we can investigate. And so I don't know that we would be able to pull up some sort of data that would support, you know, that certain groups are being targeted more or exploited more. But at the same time, again, I just know from doing the work that oftentimes groups that are put in those positions are ones who don't have a lot of other options in terms of career choices or ways to earn money.
Representative Kozlowski, anything else?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Pinto, and for that response. And I would just encourage us to continue anytime when we're working across populations and impacts to communities to make sure that we're connecting with, you know, the offices and the resources that the state has made. And so I would like to continue to work with you to make sure we're working with, you know, Office of African Heritage and Indigenous Relatives, as well as for our Latino community. What you spoke about, that prevalence of being exploited in the workplace, is obviously something that we need to continue to keep an eye on. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you. I just want to make sure, because I get fascinated with numbers here, I just want to, and maybe I misheard here, but based on these numbers that I see in here in your report, I just want to, did I hear that the claim that 1 in 4 employers are misclassifying people? Those numbers would be off the chart, and I don't see those here. Or is it 1 in 4 of the complaints that come into your office are as a result of misclassification?
Mr. Takpu? Can you help us?
Certainly. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. It is both. I was speaking in one part about how 22% of the complaints that we have gotten into our office involve misclassification. So 1 in 4. That doesn't mean that 1 in 4 employees necessarily is doing it, but that 22% of the complaints that we receive involve misclassification. In addition to that, there are studies, and I believe it was a 2024 OLA report that looked at audits from Deed in 2018, and there identified, I think coincidentally, that same number, 22% of businesses misclassified at least one worker in 2018. So again, what I think has been fairly pointed out is that these numbers are the audits and the studies that they're engaging in. There are some estimates. There's some statistics that are happening there that it's for all of you to consider and to read the reports and to learn a little bit more about it. But that's where I'm pulling those two numbers from.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Yeah. So, how many claims did you have last year?
I can't tell you exactly from the calendar year of 2024, but I could say that I believe, if I'm looking at the time period from the statistics, I believe it was around 700. But again, I wouldn't want to quote that number without being able to get back to you.
So, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Johnson, yeah.
700, and you said roughly 22% of those actual people that called in and made a claim were misclassification. And from my numbers here, I see a lot of them where you ended up doing educating and stuff like that, informing people like that. But that just seems like, so if it was 22% of the 700 actually claimed, that it's quite a leap to say that how many employers we have in this state, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And saying that 22% or hundreds of thousands of whatever that number is, possibly hundreds of thousands of employers are miscalculating either by on purpose, mistake, whatever. It just seems like it's quite a leap and change, because I like to go by what's actually people claiming as opposed to just estimating. And when you're such a wide number, I mean, I think it's very important that, you know, it seems like employers are constantly being demonized and being accused of screwing with their workers, when a lot of them, I think, are doing their best just to stay open, and are doing the best they can based on it. Because how many people are even just come out of the field? They're tradesmen. And they decide, I'm going to open up and I'm going to hire people. And they're doing the best they can. I think it's just important that we know that education probably may be necessary. They're really not trying to screw over the public. They're not trying to screw over their workers. They're doing the best they can, because they were workers at one time themselves, and they're just doing the best they can. But I'm just having a little bit of trouble going from 22% of actual claims to saying 22% of the employers in Minnesota.
Representative Johnson, I may be able to help a little bit. The Office of Legislative Auditor report from 2024 that I referenced, and that's been emailed around to all of us, so you can check it out. And they have an estimate on page 14. And actually, interestingly, it is the same number, it's 22%, but it's what they did is, this is the OLA now, working with Deed, or Deed had done audits of the unemployment insurance program and found that 22% of the employers that they audited, so they just audited any employers, 22% of those employers had misclassified at least one worker. This is back in 2018, so we need to recognize, to Representative Schultz's point, we've got a challenge of not having, you know, solid data in many cases. We're sort of doing our best. And 22% of the employers that they audited back in 2018 had misclassified at least one worker. I will say, in fairness, then scrolling down the page a bit, of the total number of employees included in the audit, the total number of employees who were misclassified were a smaller percentage. This is 4%, but recognize the percentage of employers involved was in fact 1 out of 5 from an audit, which is very different, obviously, than what Mr. Taku was referencing. Yeah, back to you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, and just sure. So I don't waste the committee's time going through the email request, how many businesses were actually audited?
Yeah, and so with the number that says here is that it looks like it would have been about 1,000. It was 291 employers that had misclassified. That was 22% of a bigger number, which is probably about 1,100, I'm guessing. So, and that was just a random audit, right? So,
right.
You know, and obviously compared to hundreds of thousands, yep. Maybe they just happened to randomly audit the employers who, Representative Green, back to you.
Thank you. And I don't know if we have Deed here, but the just important that we're all talking on the facts. One, yeah. Deed does this as a requirement of federal law. They have to audit the UI. And so, and they do it every year, I believe. Okay, it's, Devin. But this is exactly why last year we funded a report. So we want to be in data. What I think that the OLA anticipates and what the researchers anticipate is the number will go up. What we are tracking, if you look at the OLA's report, which we heard about last year, is that the all cash economy not included in that estimate. That anything that anyone who is an employer or who should be an employer who hasn't filed anything with Deed won't even be in that audit. So I think when we look at, when you look at these numbers, 22% is likely a low number of companies that have misclassified at least one worker, not a high number, but I appreciate the focus on data. What I hear is dismissing actual data we have with platitudes about what employers are doing. We should be focusing on the numbers. And right now, these are the best numbers we have. 2007, OLA told us we should measure it and it was going to go up. In 2024, they did another audit. It went up. And they told us again we should measure it. Part of the reason we passed legislation in 2024 and in 2025 is because this is a growing problem, not because of the gig economy and everything else. And so the 22%, I think, and we could have Deed come up to it. My guess is if the OLA did an audit in 2026, it may go up. But the good news is I think we're going to hear about the study that we actually have that's going to give us better and more concrete numbers that includes that whole breadth of the economy and also what it's costing the government. Because that we haven't heard that much about, but it defrauds the UI trust fund. So if a worker doesn't pay, if a employer should be and doesn't pay into the trust fund, this is why the Deed audits it. It is money that comes out of the trust fund and ultimately is socialized onto other employers. If you're not paying in PFML the same way, if you're not paying taxes, payroll taxes, it is money that is coming out of our general fund. And so when we think about that, I think it's really important that we're looking at the whole picture and the data and responding with data in kind.
Yeah, and Representative, just your hand back to you. And so hope you understood the Representative Greenman's point on top of all those other points that any employer that is misclassifying all of its workers wouldn't have shown up at all. So that number's on top of the 22% because they wouldn't have been audited. But Representative Johnson, back to you.
And then, thank you. And you're right. If people are misclassifying and they're not being fair, I was a contractor, so I know I ran up into those situations where I'd be like, how in the world did they do that? At that cheap, totally understand that. I just want to be careful because I'm here to defend our business community too, that we understand the numbers and the small numbers and the small audits that have been done, because I think it's very important not to condemn a whole group of people with the very small number that have been resulted. And as those numbers come out, and those I look forward to seeing those numbers, then we can see that. But I just want to make sure those assumptions aren't made. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. So Representative Pete Johnson is on the list next.
Thank you, Chair. I can save my question until we get down to the enforcement.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Schultz, you have something now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, this is a great conversation. I'm so glad that we're having it. This is the perfect, perfect environment to be having this at 6767. And I really appreciate the nod to data. Let's continue to be grounded in that. Mr. Chair, thank you for pointing and Representative Greenman pointing to the OLA report. I'm going to read the lines directly from page 14. Minnesota employers misclassified a relatively small share of their total employees in 2018. According to Deed's data, employers misclassified a relatively small portion of employees in 2018. Of the roughly 25,300 total employees included in Deeds audits for that year, employers misclassified about 4%, which accounted to 990. In other words, about 1 in 25 employees that Deed examined were misclassified as independent contractors or unreported to the unemployment insurance program. That is great data for us there, and I'm excited to get the additional data that should be coming soon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Yeah, there's a lot of rich information in that report, including the fact that that a number of the employees they found misclassified, employers misclassified a majority of their employees, it says at the top of the next page. So everybody can carefully peruse the report. I think we'll move on to the next, to additional presentations, but please stick around to our AG team. So grateful to you for your work on this. And so Department of Labor and Industry is making your way on up. Nicole Sorensen is first. I believe we have a presentation from you called Misclassification Fraud Impact Report. And then once you're ready, please identify yourself and proceed. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Great, thank you. Hello, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for the invitation to speak here today. I'm Nicole Sorensen, Director of Research and Data Analytics at DLI, and we'll be updating you briefly on the Misclassification Fraud Impact Report. The legislation, as you recall, charges the Departments of Revenue, Employment and Economic Development, and Labor and Industry to collaborate on a misclassification study. Specifically, we need to estimate the number of workers experiencing misclass, the cost to those workers, the prevalence by industry, and the cost across the five state funds listed on this slide. The report is due in January of next year, and every 6 years thereafter, subject to available appropriations. Because of this requirement, we are preparing to replicate the report. We are thoroughly documenting the process to ensure it is replicable in the future. Our methodology on the initial study takes into account feasibility for future replication. And lastly, the aggressive timeline of the first report may not allow for all ideal components, but we will have a documented process for future studies. For example, in the future, we may be able to conduct a survey to better estimate misclassification in the cash economy. We conducted a request for proposals for external researchers. We received four proposals, and the top scoring proposals were invited for interviews. The key considerations were qualifications and demonstrated experience researching worker misclassification specifically. The lead researcher on the top proposal is an economics faculty member at Alma College, partnering with two additional economists with misclassification research experience. A contract was executed in November, and work began immediately, allowing just over a year to complete the study. Now moving on to our methodology. A common approach in construction misclassification research is to use publicly available data to contrast how many people say they work in an industry or occupation with how many appear in employer payroll data. There are a variety of data sources listed here that could be used for this type of methodology. Legitimate independent contractors are accounted for by comparing those who say they are self-employed with those who appear in another federal data source, the non-employer statistics. The remaining gap is the share of workers who are misclassified or paid off the books. Limitations of this approach are that it cannot distinguish between misclassified and off-the-books workers and may undercount illegal employment. A second method we will be using in the study is unemployment insurance audit data to estimate the prevalence of misclass among employees that treat at least one worker as an employee. This is similar to the method used in the 2024 OLA report, and as we've been discussing recently. The limitation of this approach is that it leaves out two types of misclassification fraud: off-the-books workers and employers that treat all workers as independent contractors. A third method of estimating misclassification involves using tax filings from the Department of Revenue. The goal of this approach is to estimate the prevalence of misclassification among employers that classify all of their workers as independent contractors. The advantage of this approach is that it does not require any additional auditing, but uses the results of targeted audits to estimate misclassification among the targeted and non-targeted groups. The limitation of this approach, similar to the unemployment insurance data, is that it does not capture off-the-books workers. If not addressed, that leads to significant underestimates of the extent of payroll fraud. As such, we will attempt to use survey data to estimate off-the-books workers in our methodology as well. In addition to the data used to quantify the extent of misclassification fraud, our external researchers will also use qualitative research methods to highlight the lived experiences of misclassification, the mechanics of misclassification, and the business dynamics driving this behavior. This method will include interviews of misclassified workers, compliant employers, and people whose work relates to misclassification, as well as reviewing existing data such as testimony or case files. These research methods are complementary. They're designed to create the most comprehensive and valid analysis possible. The publicly available data has the broadest coverage. State data allows for more direct measures, and the qualitative data centers the human impact of misclassification. Using the total misclassification calculated across the data sources, we'll estimate the cost impact of misclassification on state funds. As to timeline, the research team has completed a literature review and proposed methodology. In the spring, we'll focus on data collection. The summer will be focused on data analysis and synthesizing results. And in the fall, the report will be finalized. The timeline needs to be aggressive, of course, to meet the January 2027 deadline. And at present, we are on track. So thank you for the opportunity to present here before this committee. And for any follow-up about the study, of course, please reach out. My email is listed here.
Thank you so much for the presentation and for your work. And with all the discussion of data and understanding, this is just extremely, extremely useful. And I hope all members are very happy that we funded this and moving forward with it, because it's going to be very useful. Any questions, comments from anybody? Chair Baker.
Mr. Chair, quickly, maybe I missed this and I apologize. Where are we at with the report? Did we hire an outside company to do this? And did I just miss that? I had a lot of things going on in my mind.
There's a lot happening, yeah.
I'm right there, thank you, because that's, I know we allocated some money there.
There we go, and then the request for proposal, but yeah,
there
you can just answer the chair's info.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yes, we did go through a request for proposal process and hired an external research group.
Yeah, and then the timeline, if we can maybe flip to the timeline.
Yes, thank you.
That timeline slide for the chair.
I missed that. Yeah. There it is. Thank you very much. All right.
No problem. Questions, comments from anybody else? And not seeing any, let's move to Ms. Class Enforcement. Josiah Moore, make your way on up. And I'm kidding. There's a presentation that says misclassification enforcement update. The members we should have with all the other materials. And once you're ready, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. I'm Josiah Moore. I am the legislative director at the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm just going to provide a brief misclassification enforcement update. So first, I'm just going to give the data on our intakes. So this is the calls, emails, inquiries we receive related to misclassification. This data compares calendar year 2023, which is the most recent time period before any of the misclassification law changes went into effect. So provides a sort of a good comparison.
Oh, Representative Johnson, yeah, we're having a hard time hearing you. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. Yes, I lean right on in. All right,
All right,
thank you.
So this calendar year 2023 is included because it's the best comparison to before any misclassification law changes took effect. And the second column shows sort of the first 7 months after misclassification laws took effect. That's a helpful sample because immediately the changes that went into effect were for general misclassification, and it wasn't until March 1st of 2025 that the construction misclassification changes really fully went into effect, which is why in this data you don't really see an increase in the construction intakes, but you do see an increase in sort of the other industry intakes immediately after that law. Going forward, you can see sort of some of the outcomes we have. These are should be familiar at this point. We have our wage claim process and our inform and educate process, which are more informal processes. And we saw increases there. And then our investigations are when we have that full investigation and things stay private until information stays private until an investigation is closed. And then many of the folks who reach out to us are really just looking to, for education, asking a question. So that falls into that educate and self-help. Or sometimes they have it's best to refer to another agency because they really have a tax question or something like that. Moving forward, you'll notice the time period has changed. So now we're comparing those first 7 months after the misclassification law updates were made on the left with calendar year 2025. And here we do see that big increase in construction-related intakes, which makes sense given that March 2025 effective date of most of those changes. And we continue to see intakes in all other industries increasing. In fact, I think we're going from just under 100 in calendar year 2023 to 343 in calendar year 2025 for intakes. And this is just showing the distribution of where those land for those intakes, most of which do not result in investigations. Those investigations, as referenced earlier by Mr. Pranis, are highly complex and do take a lot of time. But these wage claim and inform and educate processes do give us that path to resolve appropriate cases more quickly. Just wrapping up here, those wage claims do result in back wages for workers where appropriate, and we were able to get about $46,000 collected and distributed to workers via these wage claims. And the inform and educates can also result in wages to workers, and about $20,000 went to workers in those cases. As I referenced, the investigations are a longer process. One did close and resulted in about $5,000 in back wages to a worker. And that is the end of my presentation, and I am available for any questions.
Thank you so much. Members, that I think also is the end of our formal of the rest of our agenda, so time to open up for all kinds of things. Representative Johnson, we'll go to you. Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Looking at this topic, similar through the conversation we had yesterday around the Promise Act, and Chair Baker brought up a good point of, like, if somebody is flagged in a fraudulent application in that case, what happens? Do they start digging into other applications they might have? Where is that sent? Is it investigated, et cetera? If you find a company, and then looking at it through the lens of Mr. Woller's testimony as a contractor who's trying to do right by his workers and the projects, who continues to lose out to folks who are committing this fraud, if you find a company that is misclassifying workers, do you dig into their history? Do you dig into their future projects? Do you flag them so they have further scrutiny? What happens after you find them, or is it just a conversation about, hey, you guys should change this? This is not legal.
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. In cases where we have a finding, that those are the cases where we would refer the case to another agency who also potentially has jurisdiction in the misclassification space. So the ones who are part of the partnership, deed, revenue, are the main ones. In cases where we resolve something more informally, those are the cases where those aren't necessarily the cases where a formal referral would be appropriate.
Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Chair. And maybe it's if the Attorney General's office or anybody else can answer more, but to make sure that these companies aren't just getting a minor slap on the wrist for these violations and to ensure that they don't continue to do them because there isn't the enforcement actions that are being taken to stop that from happening, are there ways that the legislature can make sure that that is happening, that that enforcement is a little bit more robust to ensure that, one, companies don't see this as an opportunity to come in, take that work, and then bail, and then come back in under a different name, under a different partnership, under a different business? How do we stop the repeat offenders or those other folks from violating the law and committing that fraud?
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chair. That's a very big question. I think it is helpful that the legislature has sort of provided the misclass partnership language in recent years so that agencies can coordinate and work to develop recommendations for the legislature, like the ones you're referencing, that that can tackle the problem. And it's certainly helpful that we have our partners, partners in organized labor and other folks that can help with that as well. But yeah, that there's certainly work to be done, but nothing that I have a big picture answer for today.
Okay. Hold on, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Just one final comment. Yeah. To Chair Baker's questions yesterday, I agree. If somebody is flagged that they are possibly committing fraud, broadening that net a little bit to see if there's other areas to make sure that we are catching it, we are stopping it before those dollars get out the door. We should look at it in the same lens in this, that if there is a company that is doing that, they should be flagged. They should be dug into. We should go back a few years and make sure they hadn't continued to classify workers and reclaim those dollars that should have gone into the state of Minnesota, should have gone to those workers. I think one of the things that a lot of Minnesotans are really frustrated with is that different levels of enforcement for different people or different organizations, and making sure that it's clear, it's fair, it's consistent across the board for all Minnesotans, from workers to businesses and everybody else. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, do I have a bill for you? The bill that we, I don't know if we posted, but I can get you this question of how do we ensure that when someone has been cited or enforced for either by DLI for misclassification or for defrauding the trust fund or not paying their taxes, ensuring that they aren't getting other government contracts, they aren't vendors. We have the responsible contractor framework for construction, but we don't have that for the rest of the economy. We have a bill, it's House File 3093, and working on a DE to make sure that any way that misclassification shows up, because it can show up in a lot of different ways, wage theft, it can show up not enforcing in being out of compliance with UI and with taxes. If you have an enforcement action, you should not be eligible for other kinds of government money. So I appreciate that. You should sign on to it. It actually is a state gov bill because it is about applying the laws that we have just across our economy. So I'm hoping that we will hear it and pass it this year in state gov.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, you actually took a lot of my questions. So, and Mr. Wohler said something that struck me, and it connects to just other work that I've been doing with Representative Keeler around attendance and truancy for kids, and it really gets to what Representative Greenman talked about, is the siloed approach, and that is something that we have to address. But what Mr. Wohler's talked about, and one of the recommendations that he said, is talking about the unannounced visits. So can you give me a sense, or give us a sense of when you're doing an engagement with an employer, what percent is announced and what percent is unannounced?
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chair. I don't have those percentages with me today, and I'm not sure if we track that metric in our system, but I can follow up with our team, see if
please,
we track that metric, and
please do give
up
us
the committee.
Yeah, please do follow up with us. Back to you, Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, do you have, and Representative Greenman, I'm interested to learn about your bill. Obviously, the details are going to matter on this. So, but from the agency's standpoint, are there barriers in your way for you to pick up the phone and call another agency and say, hey, this is an issue? So are there barriers in your way that we can address legislatively in order to break down silos between the different state agencies?
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Bakeberg, for the question. The misclassification partnership law did provide some data sharing components that sort of scope out that question a bit, and the department and other agencies have been working on data sharing agreements through our partnership work. And I think any recommendations we might have in that space, I think, would come from that partnership work.
Good, Representative Bakeberg, yeah.
Just a quick follow-up, and that would be my challenge to all of the agencies. It shouldn't take legislative action for us to pick for agencies to pick up the phone and call another agency. We shouldn't have to pass laws. You know, the AG had an interagency recommendation or in there. We shouldn't have to pass laws to do that. That is the job of the state agencies, to be good stewards of the taxpayer dollars. And we saw that with U-Skills. We were able to break down barriers and just solve a problem. So please, 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 that's where we need to be moving to, so we don't have to have workers misclassified and have businesses be stuck in limbo as well. Like, that's our job, and that's what I would encourage the agency to focus on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Schultz, to you. I'm sorry. It is Representative Schultz. Yes, thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. I know, list. Mr. Chair, I have had a lot of time at the mic today.
So I probably would say,
for people,
and we do have a number of people in some tight time, so I probably will say, not directed at you, but at all of us, if we can keep it pretty short. Representative Schultz.
Yeah, no, this is good. Especially as it relates to enforcement, the documentation that we have in front of us, this desire to stop fraud, that we have just excellent people doing excellent work across the state, the employers, the employees. My curiosity is, you know, this has been a major topic for the Walz administration. I'm curious why the commissioner is not here this morning.
Oh, probably doing that. Mr. Moore, I suspect, probably busy with other things. Mr. Moore?
I did not prepare. Thank you, Chair. I did not prepare an answer for that one in particular.
We did not request. Okay. Here. Okay. So maybe it's more wondering why for House TFL caucus being a priority, but we've got a lot going on. Was that all, Representative Schultz?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was just thinking that this has been a pretty big deal. It's been a major conversation. Yeah. You know, we haven't had, I don't believe we've had the commissioner in here yet this session. And so certainly there's a lot of topics. Worker misclassification is one. Enforcement of ESST and others are big topics, and I'm sure we just want to make sure that we're having that appropriate oversight of the agency. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Frazier. Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presenters that have been here today. I think this has been a lively and robust conversation, and I always appreciate that. And Representative Greenman, thank you for the work that you've done. Mm-hmm. Around mm-hmm. this. I just want to ground back to this. I mean, I grew up in a poor working class community, and I think about, we're talking a lot about numbers, but these are individuals that are being impacted. That there's someone working 2, 3, 4 jobs, multiple shifts, trying to make ends meet, and they struggle oftentimes because of these barriers put in place by no fault of their hard work and determination. They're struggling to pay rent, to buy groceries, to pay their mortgage, to take a vacation, if they ever get to take one. You know, taking care of their kids, putting them in particular activities that they may not be able to afford. This is a problem that we can fix and address. We're looking at the impact that it has on our state revenue, and we're looking at, we just got a budget forecast. Think about what it means if we were to capture that revenue. Mm-hmm. We don't have the same issues. We can do more for the residents in the state if we can fix this. So I appreciate all the work that's being done on this, and I always want to ground it back to the real people that have been harmed when we don't do enough about this to address these issues.
Thank you, Chair Frazier. Chair Baker, to you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I also want to thank the committee for having this and all the folks that came forward today. To Representative Johnson's comments again, like I said yesterday, I want to go after the bad players more than anybody sitting in this room. I compete with people in my industry, too, that take advantage of things, and I want to just compete on even playing ground. And so what I get frustrated about when I look back at the years that we've admired this problem, and I say that loosely, I'm not admiring the fraud, because that's what this is. We've knowingly had a problem with fraud around unemployment rules like this, and we've got agencies that are directed to catch them. And we have got agencies that are, I think, doing a better job communicating with each other to say, hey, what are you doing over revenue? What are you doing over deed? What are you doing over here at labor? We have to do a better job, and I think that that is the most urgent thing we need to do. I get nervous when I hear we're trying to write more laws. That doesn't always fix this. It just complicates it more, because then the employers, the bad actors, are going to find different ways of doing it. My point is, let's just find a simple way to, and again, I'll ask this question before I say that, but I guess the United States Department of Labor has come out with recent new independent contractor guidelines. Have you looked at that? Have you seen what that looks like? Because what I want to try to just understand, whether you've seen it or not, it's something that came out, I think, recently from the Trump administration. Whatever it is, I haven't seen it, so I'm not saying here to defend it. What we need is a rule that we can all live with and understand it, and then go after those players so that we're on the same sort of sheet of music from our border states and whatever, but just let's catch these people, because I know the intakes coming in to the department are going up, as noted. The calls are coming in from job sites because of good employers that are saying, these people are doing it. You need to have somebody on site quickly. Again, I think that we've got to find a way to do it. I think last year, Chair Pinto and I were asking the Department of Labor, what do you need for fraud enforcement? Do you need more dollars for this? This is a good time to ask for fraud, folks, support. If you need something, this is a really good time to ask that, because folks in Minnesota that want to do legitimate business and compete evenly need to have our departments and our agencies stepping up and protecting all of us. I don't want to see people riding the coattails from other legitimate businesses so they can cut out and not pay the full payroll taxes and the other taxes that all the other businesses are continually paying. It is too burdensome. But what we also can't do is continue to just make our laws and rules more complicated so that we can't get our arms around the enforcement side of things, because our rules are different than border states or this city is different than that city. I'm trying to make it simple, but let's go after them and do what we have to do. But I don't think the answer is just always creating more stuff and more laws. I appreciate the task force too that you were on and co-chaired Representative Greenman. I just know that when we're here in a balanced house now, it wasn't that way in 23-24. And when I joined some of the meetings during that time, it just felt like it was so one-sided and there wasn't balance in that task force, in my opinion. It was hard for me to try to see how do we get to this in a way that we can actually get to it. So I appreciate the help from labor, the help from the agencies on that, but I'm looking for balance so that I can find results that are gonna really make a difference when we wanna fix these problems and go after fraudsters. And again, finally, when we do identify who they are, we do need to follow them, like Representative Pete Johnson said. Once they do that, then the Secretary of State has to get involved, so somebody else is going to sign up for a new company, same address. There has to be ways of connecting this, so we follow them down the line when they want to start switching names and covers or whatever. We can do better at this. We're smarter than that. We have to be. So, again, we've got a long ways to go. Let's just not overcomplicate it. Let's go after the bad guys, and I appreciate today's comments a lot, so thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Representative Berg, you want to get into something quick?
Thank you. I just want to build a little bit upon things that Chair Frazier said and Representative Johnson. Like, look, this isn't a Democrat versus Republican issue. The impact of worker misclassification, which is wage theft and tax fraud, means tax dollars are not going into our community tax bases. It means workers aren't spending money in our economies. Misclassified workers live in every one of our districts. Employers that engage in this undercut you, Representative Johnson. And so as we talk about balance, as we talk about impact, this isn't a one versus the other issue. The impact is in every one of our communities. The impact is to every one of our workers. And this is an issue that we shouldn't be pitted against each other for, but work together to make sure this isn't happening, both for employers that are acting in good faith, both for workers that need to be paid a fair and living wage. And so thank you for the discussion today. And thank you for the work you've done, Emma, and thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berg. And I'm actually going to, Representative Greenman, I'm going to give you the last word. I just want to make a comment. I've been reflecting on Representative Schultz's comment about studying, you know, potential benefits to consumers, and thinking that, you know, if employers don't charge sales taxes, that would lower consumer prices. And the retailer and the customer would be paying less, and yet we know that that would be a massive harm to our state if that's happening. That is something that is against the law, and we should be blocking that. This is payroll fraud discount. That was the phrase that was used by one of the testifiers. I think that's such a good point that this is something that is a fraud that benefits the person doing it at the expense of everybody else, workers and government and all of us. And we need to view this in the same way as we would somebody that's not paying their taxes, that's defrauding in any way. And I really want to make sure that we're focused on that. And grateful, as others have said, to Representative Greenman, for your leadership on this. And I'll give you the last word in this hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Baker, I know we've been having this conversation for a long time, and the work of the task force, which you were nice enough to host us at, is really, I sort of encourage folks, in addition to looking at the recommendations, and this is my plug, is all of that testimony, which we heard from workers, we heard from gig companies, we heard from a lot of employers, we did a whole day on that. A lot of that made it into these recommendations, and when we talked about education, when we talked about notice, and when we talked, we heard from folks like Matt Wallers and Jesse Madison, who I think we've heard from at the task force before, talking about this is about an even playing field. One of the things I will say is work left to do is we have started to really look at this business model, and as we have talked about a lot in the when we look at other places of fraud, we are never going to site visit or enforcement at the end our way out of it if we have a opaque, convoluted, siloed, structured at the top, which leaves all sorts of opportunities for people who are trying to cheat, who are trying to get a head up on a bid, or are just frankly trying to make money. It's not, it won't work. And so when we think about, and I just want to encourage folks, the work ahead is, and we are one of states, 50 states are all looking at this. The federal government has been looking at this. To get at the business model, and I will share this, we looked at a four-page document of the tests, deed, DLI, and revenue, and they are all different. They all have different levels of balancing. And one of the things that is very hard is if you are a new employer and you're trying to figure it out, or if you're a worker and you're trying to figure it out, we have created tests for courts, but not for workers and employers. And so I think that the work, it is often the thing that is opposed, especially by the biggest businesses, because if we have a very clear, simple test, frankly, it's harder to evade it. But we do have to get into that work. We started and have been really deep in the enforcement work. I think we need to think more about both education and how we do that notice, as well as what a test looks like. What should the presumption be when we talk about these? Because we have, and this will be a final comment, we have decided over the last almost 100 years at the federal and state level to build the entire protections for workers on top of the employment framework. We could have done it differently. But contracting is actually, it's just contract law. And all of the protections, and we talked about a lot of the ones that impacted people's bottom lines, but the right to organize, anti-discrimination laws, and all of the benefits and protections are built on employment. And that's why it's so important that we take what Minnesota has done, which is said we have a preference for employment, and actually put that into law. So I'm looking forward to more work. I'm looking forward to folks should dig in to some of those. You don't have to you look at the recommendations, but also listen to some of that testimony, because we spent a lot of time listening to folks across the state and across industries. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman, for your work, and thanks all for the great discussion. Chair Baker, preview.
Preview for next Tuesday, everybody. We're going to be looking at unemployment insurance and why are we paying kind of that high level of assessment right now for our businesses. We're hoping to also talk about the energy code and what's happening with the repeat updates and the cost of what it's really costing us with our housing especially. And we're hoping to get a preview of the Minnesota Chamber paid family medical leave, kind of initial feedback from some of their members that they're able to share. So just we're hoping that that's on your docket. So get excited. Grab the popcorn. It's going to be a good day. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thanks again to all. With that, the meeting is adjourned.